college and then you can do whatever you want. I'm sick of wasting time and I want my car back. I hate not driving. I feel trapped. She controlled herself, not telling him that it was ludicrous to expect their parents to trust him on the road again. It's just 2 more years of your life, Raoul. Try to stick it out. Otherwise, you'll end up hating yourself.
Jesus, you sound just like them, he said, and hung up on her.
She returned to Boston in April, during the break after the Lent term, a diamond ring from Roger concealed on a chain beneath her sweater, and this made her feel dipped in a protective coating from her family. After January, her parents had not bothered her again about Raoul, telling her, the one time she asked, that he'd gone back to school. She felt guilty for distancing herself, but not enough to counsel her parents, not enough to speak to Raoul. She had a 10,000-word dissertation to write on deregulation for her degree, and she had Roger, had moved in with him by then. She was surprised to see Raoul standing at the airport with her parents. All 3 of them looked sad, preoccupied, her parents perking up only when they caught sight of her behind her trolley piled with bags. Hey, she said, walking up to him, hugging him, though initially his long arms remained at his side. It's good to see you. Welcome home, he said, and when he stepped back, she saw he was not smiling. Is your semester finished already? He shook his head, still refusing to meet her gaze, and then a small, odd-sounding laugh escaped from him. I live here now. She had come home to tell her family about Roger, to tell them she planned to move permanently to London and marry him, but it was Raoul they had to talk about first. During the ride home from the airport, she pieced together what had happened. It was her mother who did the talking. Her father drove, muttering to himself now and then about the condition of the traffic, and Raoul spent most of the time staring out the window, as if he occupied the back of a cab. Though he returned to Ithaca after Christmas break, he'd stopped going to classes, and 2 weeks ago, after being formally dismissed from the university, he moved back to Wayland. From what Suda could tell, he was living in the house as if it were simply another vacation. He stayed in his room, or watched television during the day. Their parents had sold his car, and so he never went out. Previously, when he had avoided them, there was something bristling in him, something about to explode. That energy was missing now. He no longer seemed upset with them, or with the fact that he was at home. For a while, her parents told their friends that he was taking a leave of absence, and then that he was in the process of transferring to BU. Raoul needs a city in order to thrive, they said. But he never applied to other schools. They told people Raoul was looking for a job, and then the lie became more elaborate. And Raoul had a job, a consulting job from home, when in fact he stayed home all day doing nothing. Their mother, who had always hoped her children would live under her roof, was now ashamed that this was the case. Eventually he got a job managing a laundromat in Wayland 3 days a week. Her parents bought a cheap used car so that Raoul could drive into town. Suda knew that the job embarrassed her parents. They had not minded him washing dishes in the past, but now they lived in fear of the day someone they knew would see their son weighing sacks of dirty clothes on a scale. Other Bengalis gossiped about him and prayed their own children would not ruin their lives in the same way. And so he became what all parents feared. A blot, a failure, someone who was not contributing to the grand circle of accomplishments Bengali children were making across the country, as surgeons, or attorneys, or scientists, or writing articles for the front page of the New York Times. Suda was among those successful children now, her collection of higher degrees framed and filling up her parents' upstairs hall. She was working as a project manager for an organization in London that promoted microloans in poor countries. And she was spoken for. In the summer, she and Roger flew to Massachusetts so that he could meet Suda's family and ask formally for her hand. At Roger's request, they stayed not in Wayland, but in a hotel in Boston. By now she knew him well enough to accept that he would maintain a limited exposure to her family, just as he guarded his body, on the beach, from the rays of the sun. Better to be upfront about these things at the start, Roger had told Suda in his kind but firm way, and she took this as another sign of his responsible nature, his vigilance toward their life together. The hotel arrangement was accepted by her parents without protest. Raoul had stripped them of their capacity to fight back. They accepted that she and Roger planned to have a registry wedding in London, that they were willing to have only a reception in Massachusetts, that Roger had been previously married, that he and Suda had a 14-year gap. They approved of his academic qualifications, his ability, thanks to his wisely invested inheritance, to buy a house for himself and Sudha in Kilburn. It helped that he had been born in India, that he was English and not American, drinking tea, not coffee, and saying Z, not Z, superficial things that allowed her parents to relate to him. Sudha felt they were not so much making room for Roger in the family as allowing him to take her away. But Raoul had not loosened his grip. He asked Roger questions, combing through the current issue of Roger's art magazine that her parents had admired and set aside, doing his part to inspect his sister's future husband for flaws. "Roger's a good guy," Raoul told her when the two of them were alone in the kitchen clearing plates. "Congratulations."
"Thanks. Thanks for being here," she said. She meant it. She'd never brought a man to the house, hadn't realized how nervous she'd be.
"Got nowhere else to go."
"So, how are things?" she asked. "It's not driving you crazy living at home this way?"
"It's not so bad."
She was grateful that he was talking to her, afraid to pressure him. She was aware of a horrible imbalance between them. She felt accused simply because her life wasn't broken in the same way.
"How's the laundromat?"
He shrugged.
"Are you still writing your play?"
"It was stupid."
Not knowing what else to do, she stepped forward to hug him, and it was then that she smelt the liquor, sweet, strong, unmistakable. During lunch, he'd gotten up from the table once. Now she realized he'd gone wherever the bottle was hidden. He was not drunk. There was nothing about his behavior to indicate that he'd had more than a single drink. But the fact that he'd consumed the alcohol in stealth, that he could not endure her family's company without it, made her realize that Raoul was not simply fond of drinking, or a social drinker, or a binge drinker, which were all the ways she'd rationalized it until now.
"You're welcome to visit us in London any time," she offered,
saddened by the fact that she did not mean it.
"I don't have any money."
"I'm sure Baba would buy you a ticket."
"I don't want his money," Raoul said.
"You live in his house," she wanted to point out. "You eat the food Ma puts on the table. You let them put gas in your car." But she said none of this, knowing that if she did, the door he tentatively held open for her benefit would slam once more in her face. In the months before Sudha's wedding reception, planned for the fall, Raoul began dating a woman named Elena. Elena was an aspiring actress, and she was a waitress at a diner in Waltham. He had conveyed these facts to Sudha when she came back to Wayland 10 days before the reception, without Roger, who would be flying in for the party alone.
"I've never felt this way before, Didi," he told her.
A few days before the reception, he brought Elena home. Sudha was a married woman now, but being without Roger made her anxious, that protective coating he provided suddenly thinning. Elena was 30, 8 years older than Raoul, but she could have passed for a high school student, wearing tight jeans and a tank top, her long brown hair fastened at one side with a barrette, dark liner rimming her eyes. She was quiet, speaking only when spoken to, not working to charm Sudha's parents as Roger had. She told them she'd grown up in Mattapoisett and had gone to Emerson. She did not eat the rice Sudha's mother served with lunch, saying that it caused her bloating. Raoul kept his arm around her thin shoulders, kissing her dreamily in front of everyone. He spoke on Elena's behalf, saying that she had once made a commercial for an allergy medicine. He kept mentioning someone named Crystal. It turned out that Crystal was Elena's daughter from a previous boyfriend. Sudha's parents said nothing as this information was divulged. They had welcomed Elena, filled their table in her honor as they had done for Roger, making chit-chat about the big dig and the menu for Sudha and Roger's reception. But then, as Sudha and her mother were bringing out tea and a bowl of pantuas in their syrupy bath, Raoul announced that he and Eleanor were engaged. Sudha froze behind a chair, gripping the spoons she was in the process of distributing. The room seemed to tilt. She pressed down on the tablecloth as if a forceful wind were about to come and blow everything away. She looked down at the diamond on her finger, imagining the same thing on Eleanor's hand, wondering where in the world her brother would get the money to buy a ring. The Darjeeling brought out for special occasions grew too strong in the pot, the reddish-brown pantuas still crowded together in their serving bowl.
"That's not possible," their father said finally, breaking the silence that he had been maintaining, it seemed to Sudha, for over a year.
"What's not possible about it?" Raoul asked.
He still had an arm around Elena, his index fingers stroking the side of her neck.
You are only a boy. You have no career, no goal, no path in life. You're in no position to be getting married. And this woman, their father said, registering Elena's presence only for an instant before turning away, is practically old enough to be your mother. They were even. Equilibrium, if it could be called that, restored to the room. But Sudha knew that it was the furthest thing from equilibrium, that in fact it was war.
You're a snob, Raoul said. You're nothing but a pathetic old snob. There was no rage in his voice, none of the violence Sudha had expected.
He stood up in a fluid motion, seeming to lift Elena to her feet as well, as if his arm were a magnet for her form, and then the two of them left the house. Sudha and her parents waited until they heard the sound of Elena's car backing out of the driveway, and then her mother began to pour the tea.
I have been thinking, her father said, turning to Sudha, breaking the silence for the second time. The restaurant where we'll have the wedding reception? There is a bar?
All restaurants have bars, Baba.
I'm concerned about Raoul. He has no control when it comes to...
He paused, searching for the word he wished to use.
When it comes to that.
Sudha shut her eyes, thinking she might cry. All this time she had been waiting for her parents to acknowledge Raoul's drinking, but hearing her father say it now, after what had just happened, was too much.
Maybe we should hold it somewhere else, her mother suggested. Somewhere without drinks.
It's too late for that, and it's not fair, Sudha said. Sudha and Roger expected to be able to drink at their own wedding reception, she maintained. Why should everyone be punished because of Raoul?
Can't you ask him not to drink too much on that day? Her mother asked.
No, Sudha said, pushing back her chair and standing up. She had been fiddling all this time with her teaspoon, and she flung it now, ineffectually, on the carpeted floor of the dining room, where it fell without sound.
I can't talk to him anymore. I can't fix him. I can't keep fixing what's wrong with this family, she said,
and like her brother, only a little while earlier, she stormed out of the room. During the reception, Raoul made a toast. It was a tribute to Sudha and Roger, but Sudha held her breath as he spoke, wanting him only to sit down. He was without Elena. The day after walking out with her, he'd returned abject, alone. Sudha wondered if Elena had broken up with him, but she didn't ask. She wondered if Raoul would not attend the reception, but he was at the restaurant an hour early, maintaining his rightful place in the family, greeting people as they arrived, showing them to the sign-in book. There were almost all friends of Sudha's parents, almost all Bengali. No one from Roger's side had come. The toast went on, the words becoming slurred. Before the reception, her father had spoken with the bartender, paying him extra to monitor Raoul's drinks. Sudha did not have the heart to tell her father that Raoul was beyond such measures, that alcohol dwelled in his pockets where most men's wallets were, that the two glasses of champagne he'd had openly were just for show. Raoul began telling a story about Sudha's childhood, dredging up an anecdote about going on vacation long ago in Bar Harbor, Sudha needing to use the bathroom and there not being a gas station for miles. Then their father got up, stood next to Raoul and whispered something in his ear, motioning for him to sit down.
Excuse me, I'm not finished.
People laughed, not realizing Raoul had not meant to be funny, that it wasn't some sort of comic routine. The microphone made a screeching sound. Their father took him by the elbow then, and Raoul flinched, giving a shove.
You don't touch me, Raoul hissed,
the words amplified by the microphone. One of Sudha's parents' friends got up to make another toast, but Sudha didn't hear it. She was aware of guests talking among themselves in front of their plates of pink tandoori and her brother heading toward the bar. When she got up to look for him, he was no longer there, his car missing from the parking lot. She alerted her parents, prepared herself for another call from the police. But no one was in a position to search for him in the middle of the reception, and without him there, perversely, her parents began to relax. Only Sudha couldn't relax. Roger, who had a little too much champagne himself, told her not to worry.
He's been going through a rough time, he observed dispassionately as he led her on the dance floor. He's young.
She stared at her husband, wanting to scream at him for believing in Raoul in a way she no longer could. She had never told Roger about the old game of hiding beer cans, a fact that now tortured her. But once again, she chose not to tell Roger, fearing that he would blame her, that he would judge Raoul. It was like the painting they'd first looked at together in London, the small mirror at the back revealing more than the room at first appeared to contain. And what was the point of making Roger lean in close to see what she was already forced to? It turned out Raoul hadn't gone far, only back to their parents' house, where they found him at the end of the night in his bedroom asleep. The following morning, Roger and Sudha flew off for their honeymoon. She felt neutralized in the air, sealed off in the cabin, the unnaturally strong sunlight bleaching out the events of the night before. But as soon as they touched down in St. Thomas, she felt tainted all over again, hearing Raoul hissing into the microphone, insulting her father, and pushing him in front of all their friends. Life went on. Sudha and Roger returned to London, settling into their new house, writing cards to thank their guests for helping to make it such a special day. But Sudha could not forgive Raoul for what had happened, those dreadful minutes he stood at the microphone, the only thing she remembered when she looked at the photographs of her reception, all the posed portraits on the grass in which they were smiling, leading up to that. And then he disappeared for good. There was no note, no explanation. He simply left one night, her parents said, and had not returned. By then his comings and goings were so erratic that their parents had not fully absorbed the fact of his absence until a few days had passed. Then they realized that his toothbrush was not in the bathroom, and that one of the big suitcases normally used for trips to India was not in the basement. He must have decided to visit a friend, her parents said, but they knew none of Raoul's new friends and were unable to make calls. They reported that the car was missing, and it was located the next day, abandoned at a bus station in Framingham. Roger, trying to be helpful, suggested they contact Eleanor, but they had never known Eleanor's last name. After a week, a letter came, with a postmark from Columbus, Ohio. It was not addressed to anyone. He had not even put the family surname on the envelope. "Don't bother looking for me here," he had written. "I'm only spending the night. I don't want to hear from any of you. Please leave me alone." They wondered how he got to Ohio, since he had no money, wondered if he had hitched rides. A week passed before her mother noticed that the small zippered pouches she kept hidden at the back of her drawers, behind her jumble of British brassieres, containing all the gold jewels she'd acquired over her lifetime, all the pieces representative of her husband's success in America, much of which was intended to go to whatever woman Raoul eventually married, were missing. He had been gone 2 months when Sudha discovered that she was pregnant. One night during her miserable honeymoon, her body had begun to make a life. Suddenly, alongside the terrible, there was now the wonderful. The good news reviving her parents. Sudha thought of Raoul often during her pregnancy, invaded by memories and dreams of their childhood, recalling the existence that had produced them both, an experience that was both within her and behind her, and that Roger would never understand. In her first trimester, her emotions dipped and soared without warning. On good days, she believed that Raoul needed to get away in order to put his life back together. On bad days, she feared that the police would call her parents saying his body had been found in a ditch. He was absent the following Christmas, which Sudha and Roger spent in Wayland, absent at the hospital in London the night she gave birth to Neil. And she got used to it, used to having a brother she never saw. Wrapped up with Neil, her parents got used to it too, coming to London out every opportunity, their tiny grandson plugging up the monstrous hole Raoul left in his wake. For hours they stared into the bassinet, at the stern, downy creature with Roger's pale skin and Sudha's dark hair, and a destiny all his own. After a few months, Sudha returned to work, first 3 days a week, then five, leaving the house at 8:30 and returning at 6, taking Neil from the nanny and spending just 2 hours with him, first in the bath, and then nursing him to sleep in the rocker. She felt awful, always, that it was for such a brief piece of her day that she actually cared for Neil. But she reminded herself that he was too young to resent her for it, his face lighting up at the sight of her, leaping into her arms as if she was the most wonderful being on earth. It was then, at a time when her life was at its most demanding and also gratifying, that she returned home on cold Saturday from grocery shopping and found, on the other side of the door slot, an envelope from America addressed in Raoul's hand. She stood in the entryway of the house, with the brown and gold wallpaper she and Roger kept meaning to tear down, staring at that simple but certain proof of Raoul's existence. She wondered how he'd gotten her new address, but then she remembered, when she was home for a wedding reception, writing it on a piece of paper and taping it to her parents' refrigerator. Neil napped in his stroller, not knowing the existence of his uncle, not knowing the shock that filled his mother's eyes with tears. There was a faded postmark from New York, and on the back of the envelope, a post office box somewhere upstate. Before opening the envelope, she pulled out an atlas. The town was north of Ithaca. She was stunned. She had assumed he'd gone as far as possible to Oregon or California. She never thought he'd want to return anywhere near the place where he'd so spectacularly failed. Inside was a single sheet of paper that he'd stuck into a typewriter. "Dear Dee Dee, I hope this is you. First, I want to say that I'm sorry. For everything. I know I screwed up. But things are better now. I have a job at a restaurant as a line cook. I discovered that I really like cooking. Nothing fancy, but I've gotten really good at omelets. Also, I'm writing another play. I showed it to someone I met here, a guy who's directed some things at Syracuse, and he said it still needs work, but that I should stick with it. I'm living with Elena. Remember her? We got back together and I convinced her to come up here. Crystal's in fifth grade and Elena got a job doing human resources at the university. Think what you will about Elena, but she got me to start rehab. So like I said, things are better. Anyway, I'm sorry for everything and I hope you, and Roger, can forgive me for being a jerk at your wedding. I really am happy for you guys, and I'd like to come to London and see you if that's okay. I've saved up some money and I'll have a little time off from the restaurant this summer. I'm assuming you won't mention any of this to our parents. Raoul." She replied immediately, without rereading the letter or bothering to ask Roger if it was all right for Raoul to stay with them. She tore a sheet of paper out of the notebook they kept by the phone for messages and wrote, "Dear Raoul, yes, it's me. I've had a baby, a boy named Neil. He's 10 months old, and I want you to meet him." She stopped, then signed the letter. She had nothing more to say. She had not seen Raoul since her wedding night, a fact that was incredible to her. "Hi, Dee Dee," he said when she opened the door, still using the traditional term of respect their parents had taught him. She felt no awkwardness, the sight of him after over a year and a half standing under the portico of the house, completing a part of her that had been missing, like the clothes she could wear again now that the weight of her pregnancy was gone. "Here he is," she said to Raoul, adjusting Neil in her arms. Neil stuck out a hand, his fingers gripping a digestive biscuit. He babbled softly, taking in the new person in front of him. "That's right," Raoul said, stroking Neil's cheek with the back of his index finger. "It's your screw-up uncle finally here to see you." He shook his head in disbelief, acquainting himself with the details of Neil's face, the nose and eyes and mouth, and wisps of hair that Sudha felt she had known all her life. It was Raoul who'd changed. He'd put on weight, enough so that his once refined features appeared common, his neck and waistline thick. He had acquired the stoop of an older, uncertain man. His hair was combed back from his head, receding above the temples, the sideburns long. His jeans had lost their stiffness, frayed at the hems. The pinstripe blazer looked like it had come from a thrift store and was a little short in the sleeves. "I can't believe you were born and I didn't know it. You're absolutely perfect," he said to Neil. He looked at Sudha, then Neil, then back at Sudha. "He's got your face totally." "You think? I see Rogers." Raoul shook his head. "No way, Dee Dee. This boy is a Mukherjee through and through." She gave him a tour of the house. The kitchen and a small toilet in the basement, the parlor above, two bedrooms and a bathroom above that, Roger's study under the eaves. In spite of all the stories, the house was diminutive, and they were constantly going up and down the staircase, which these days Neil was also attempting to climb. The steps were too much for Sudha's father, who had recently developed bursitis in his knee, and when her parents last visited London, they'd stayed with friends in the suburbs. But Roger had agreed to let Raoul sleep on the daybed normally covered with papers in the study. "Feel free to take a nap," she told Raoul. But he declined, coaxing Neil into his arms and not letting go as Sudha peeled potatoes and prepared to roast a chicken. He took in the low-ceilinged space, with its black-and-white checkerboard floor, a perpetually cluttered dining table. Spode plates and copper molds hung on yellow walls. Roger had painted the walls himself, the final layer applied with a sponge. Raoul stopped in front of some shelves where the cookbooks were, along with photographs in frames. Most of the photos were of Neil, in the hours after his birth, in the arms of Sudha's parents, sitting in a stroller outside the house. There were no pictures of Raoul. "When was this taken?" he asked. "Which?" "It looks like an anaplasm." "Oh, that," she said, pricking a fork into a lemon, thinking back to the day Neil was fed his first meal a few months before, her parents flying to London for the occasion. "It was just a tiny thing at home," she told him, as if that would explain away Raoul's absence. It was the maternal uncle who traditionally fed the child. In Neil's case, it had been Sudha's father. He crossed the floor to where she stood at the butcher block and removed his wallet from his back pocket. With one hand he shook it so it displayed a school portrait of a smiling young girl with freckles and two long brown ponytails. "This is Crystal," he said proudly, explaining that he arranged to be home every day when Crystal got home from school, making her a snack and then cooking her dinner before Elena returned and he went off to a shift at the restaurant. He didn't pull out a picture of Elena, but Sudha remembered her clearly from that one time she'd come to lunch. Sudha didn't ask Raoul if he and Elena had gotten married, if they were going to have a child of their own. Sudha had tried to help her brother, but it was Elena who had succeeded. "She's a great kid," he said before putting away Crystal's picture. "I thought I'd get her a little tea set, you know? Something really English. She'd love that." He lifted Neil into the air, shaking him playfully, rubbing his face against Neil's belly, Neil cackling hysterically. "Careful," Sudha warned. Raoul obliged, stopping the game and hugging Neil tightly, then beginning to tickle him so that the cackle started up again. "Relax, Didi, I'm a parent too now." Sudha and Roger had white wine with dinner, but Raoul had asked only for club soda mixed with some orange juice. They ate outside at a small table on the garden patio, overlooking the rose bushes that thrived in spite of Sudha and Roger's neglect. She had wondered about the wine, whether or not to drink it in front of Raoul. There were a few bottles of scotch and vodka in their kitchen cabinets left over from a housewarming party she and Roger had thrown, and she stuffed them into the back of her closet and into the sweater chest at the foot of their bed, telling herself that Roger would never notice. Neil sat in Raoul's lap, eating small dollops of mashed potato from Roger's extended finger. "First time in London, is it?" Roger asked Raoul. "Apart from sitting in Heathrow dozens of times on the way to Calcutta," Raoul said. And Sudha was reminded of all those trips they'd taken in childhood to see their relatives, trips that would never take place again. They had slept beside one another on the same bed, often bathed together, taken everything in with one pair of eyes. Raoul mentioned things he wanted to see in the course of the week, the British Museum, Freud's house, the V&A, asking if it was possible to go to Stratford-upon-Avon for the day. He seemed suddenly desperate to interact with the world after all those years of sitting up in his room. Roger told him when the museums were open, what was currently on exhibit, and it struck Sudha how little her husband and her brother were acquainted, that they remained all but strangers. "Mainly I want to spend time with Neil," Raoul said. "I can take him out to a park or a zoo, whatever." Sudha told Raoul to enjoy himself, that Neil spent the days with a nanny, but that in the evening his nephew would be all his. "So when's the next one?" Raoul asked, draping Neil over his legs, jiggling them up and down. "Next what?" Roger asked. "The next kid." "Have you been talking to Ma?" Sudha said, beginning to laugh before abruptly stopping herself. "What do you want, buddy?" Raoul asked, looking down at Neil's upturned face. "A little brother like me, or a sister?" Now that the subject of their parents had come up, she decided to give Raoul their news, that their father was retiring at the end of the year, and that their parents were shopping for a flat in Calcutta. "That's where they are now," she said. "They're not in Wayland?" "No." It was a fact that had made it easier for Sudha to honor Raoul's request and not tell her parents about his visit. "Are they moving back for good?"
"Maybe."
She told him about their father's knee trouble, that he was going to have surgery to have fluid drained. One day she knew it would be something more serious, and when it came, as long as Raoul stayed away, she would have to be an only child all over again. After dinner, Roger put away the leftovers while Sudha went upstairs to run Neil's bath. Raoul came with her, sitting on the toilet and blowing some bubbles he had brought for Neil, as she crouched on the floor and soaped and rinsed him. Neil was ecstatic about the bubbles, waiting wide-eyed for each to emerge from the little plastic wand, reaching out and popping them, and calling out for more. Okay, little guy, time for bed, she said after a few minutes, lifting the rubber plug and letting the water drain out of the clawfoot tub. She reached for Neil's towel, throwing it over her shoulder and lifting him out. She wrapped him up, scrubbing his head. Say goodnight to Mamu, she said. What does he call them? Raoul asked.
Who?
Our parents. She hesitated, though the answer was not something she had to search for.
Dadu and Didi?
Just like we did, he said, his voice softening. I bet they treat you like a king, he said to Neil.
You could say that. We still haven't unwrapped some of his Christmas presents.
What about next Christmas? Do you guys have plans?
They're supposed to come to London, Suda began, watching for a reaction.
Of course you're welcome, she continued, knowing the idea was ludicrous. All of you, Elena and Crystal, you guys could stay in a hotel.
She stopped then, realizing that she was holding her breath, waiting for him to walk out of her life all over again. Instead, he said, I'll think about it, leaving her even more breathless, for she realized that without a formal truce, the battle had ended, that he wanted to come back.
Raoul was already awake when she came downstairs the next morning, sitting at the table with Roger, a t-shirt sticking to his thickened body, sweaty hair plastered to his face. He was wearing shorts, the hair on his dark legs curlier than she remembered. Roger was drinking his tea, showing Raoul a tube map, telling him which trains went where, pointing out parks in which he could run.
Where did you go? She asked Raoul.
She prepared a pot of coffee, then warmed the milk for Neil's Weetabix, knowing he would be up soon.
No idea, he said. I just go for an hour. Running's my new addiction.
It was the first time since he arrived that he'd alluded in any way to his drinking. That and coffee. When it was ready, she poured him a cup, watched him add 3 spoons of sugar, remembered the first time he'd visited her in college, and she'd handed him his first beer.
What will you do today?
Raoul shrugged. Maybe a museum. I just want to walk around.
Be ready in 20 minutes and I'll drop you at the tube, Roger offered.
While Suda was at work, she wondered what her brother was doing, wondered if one of the hundreds of pubs on the streets of London would tempt him. Part of her worried that something would set him off, and that he would disappear again. But when she got back to the house that evening, she found Raoul crawling up the staircase after Neil, pretending to be a hungry lion. That night they went out for curry, and again he did not drink, covering the paper spread on the table with elaborate drawings. Again he sat with Suda in the bathroom as she bathed Neil, and the following morning he went for his run. For the rest of the week, he worked through his list of activities, always returning with a little gift for Neil. It felt strange to be at work for so much of the time that Raoul was visiting, but Suda thought it was better, safer, that their time together was limited to mornings and evenings, times when Roger and Neil were around. Saturday morning, Raoul made omelets, expertly chopping mushrooms and onions the way chefs did on television, and then at Raoul's suggestion, they went to the London Zoo. Raoul had offered to take Neil himself, and though throughout the week both Suda and Roger had taken advantage of Raoul's presence, leaving him in charge for 5 or 10 minutes if they needed to go to the corner for eggs or bread, there was no question of that. And yet, once they were at the zoo, both Roger and Suda felt obsolete. Raoul carried Neil on his shoulders the whole time, the stroller Suda pushed containing nothing but her purse. Neil was equally smitten, bursting into tears when Raoul had to use the restroom. Raoul had insisted on paying for everything, buying them their tickets, their sandwiches and sodas, the ice cream for Neil, the lime green balloon that drifted all afternoon above their heads.
I was thinking of going to a movie later, Raoul said when they returned to the house, still carrying Neil. But I think I'd rather stay home with this guy.
Don't be silly, Suda said. You've dealt with him all day. You deserve a break. Raoul shook his head. I'm leaving tomorrow, and we've got a lot of catching up to do. And then he said, you two are the ones who need a break. When was the last time you saw a movie together?
The idea presented itself. A perfect plan that felt all wrong.
She looked over at Roger, and Raoul saw her looking.
What, you guys don't trust me?
Of course, Roger said. He turned to Suda.
Shall we, Sue?
She reminded herself that they had a cell phone. The movie theater was a 10-minute drive from the house. If they went to an early show, they'd be back in time for Neil's bath.
I'll call to see what's playing, she said.
We'll be right here, Raoul promised, looking up from the sitting room floor where he and Neil were stacking blocks, and she forced herself to believe him. They had not left him a key. There was nowhere he could go. She had left food for Neil, milk in a sippy cup, overcooked macaroni that was impossible to choke on. She had reminded Raoul to be careful with Neil on the stairs. During the movie, she kept the volume of her cell phone turned on, not trusting it to vibrate in the pocket of her jeans. After the first hour, she got up and called from the lobby. "Everything okay?"
"Everything's great," Raoul told her.
"He seemed hungry, so I'm giving him something to eat." In the background, she could hear Neil banging something, a cup or a spoon, against the tray of his high chair.
"Great. Thanks. We'll be back soon," she said.
"No need to rush," Raoul said. And so on their way back, at Roger's suggestion, they stopped at a market for cheese and jams and a few other things they needed. They bought 3 nice steaks for dinner, Roger saying he would make a tart. Raoul and Neil were not in the sitting room where she expected to find them, not playing among the toys scattered across the carpet. A children's show was on television, but no one was watching it. Downstairs in the kitchen, the high chair had not been wiped, and gummy bits of pasta were submerged in a puddle of water on the surface of the tray. The balloon from the zoo had been tied to the side, reaching almost to the ceiling. All the upper cupboards were open, but nothing seemed to have been removed from them. Quickly, Sudha shut them, a cold sweat forming on her lips.
"They haven't left. The pushchair's still here," Roger said.
As she raced up the stairs, she heard the sound of water splashing and chided herself for panicking.
"It's okay," she called out. "He's giving Neil a bath."
She found Neil in the tub, filling his sippy cup with water and pouring it out. He was sitting without the plastic ring they normally put him in so that he wouldn't tip over. He was trembling but otherwise happy, intent on his task, the water up to the middle of his chest, the mere sight of him sitting there, unattended, causing Sudha to emit a series of spontaneous cries and a volt of fear to seize her haunches. The water was no longer warm. One slip and he would have been face down, his fine dark hair spread like a sunburst, the strands waving as the rest of him was still.
"Where's your uncle?" Roger demanded, even though Neil did not yet have the words to reply. He yanked Neil out of the tub, making him burst into tears.
They found Raoul in Roger's study, asleep, a glass tucked beneath the daybed. In their bedroom, the sweater chest was open, the necks of the bottles poking out, nestled in woolly arms. They went back to Roger's study and were unable to rouse Raoul, Sudha shaking his shoulder as she held Neil. Roger leaned over Raoul's duffel, stuffing it with clothes.
"What are you doing?" she asked. "What does it look like, Sudha?"
"He'll do that when he gets up."
Roger stood up, his face not at all kind. "I'm making it easier for him. I don't want your brother to set foot in our home or come near our child again." Because they could not scream at Raoul, they began to scream at each other, the strange calm that had followed their discovery in the bathtub now shattered.
"You're the one who told him we trusted him," she said. "You agreed to go out."
"Don't blame this on me," Roger said. "I barely know him. Don't you dare blame a bit of this on me."
"I'm not," she said, beginning to cry. "I'm sorry. I should have told you."
"Told me what?"
She was sobbing now, too hard for any words to come out. Neil beginning to cry in reaction. Roger went up to her, holding her by the shoulders, his arms outstretched.
"Told me what?"
Somehow, in spite of how hard she was crying, she told him about the very first time Raoul had come to visit her at Penn, and how he hadn't even liked beer, and then about all the cans they'd hidden over the years, and how eventually it was no longer a game for him but a way of life that had removed him from her family and ruined him. Roger looked around the study with its book-lined walls, its cabinet full of files, postcards of noble portraits pinned over the desk. A disgusted look appeared on his face, and then he looked at Sudha, his disgust for her just as plain.
"You lied to me. I've never lied to you, Sudha. I would never have kept something like this from you."
She nodded. She was still crying, tightly holding Neil. Roger took their son from her arms and left her there with Raoul, who was flat on his back, one leg dangling over the edge of the daybed, his slackened face to the wall. All night she did not sleep, Roger stiff as a board on his side. They'd gone to bed hungry, the 3 steaks tossed into the freezer. Raoul had never woken up. She knew Roger was right, knew that if it had been his sibling, she would have said and done the same. She thought of her parents, who had believed their children were destined to succeed, had fumbled when one failed. After everything Raoul had put them through, they never renounced him, never banished him. They were incapable of shutting him out. But Roger was capable, and Sudha realized as the wakeful night passed that she was capable, too. She drifted off around daybreak, then woke up an hour later, hearing the shower running. It ran for a long time. She became nervous and considered knocking, but then she heard the door open, and a few minutes later, footsteps padding down the stairs. "I meant to clean up the high chair," Raoul said when she joined him in the kitchen. He was dressed in one of Roger's bathrobes, squinting as if the subterranean space were flooded with light. His voice was gruff, the effects of liquor clear in the delicate yet awkward way he was moving about. He had filled the kettle with water, turned on the gas, measured coffee into the glass pot.
"Sorry about that."
"I thought you were better." He glanced at her only for a second. He looked like an idiot to her, dull and slow. "What the hell happened, Raoul?" He didn't reply. "Is it me?" she asked, for she had wondered this during the long hours she had lain awake. Wondered if seeing her had reminded him of the past, of those nights they had defied their parents together, pouring warm beer into cups of ice and forging a link all their own. The water began to boil, the kettle emitting a thin whistle. She switched off the gas, poured the water into the coffee pot. "You have to go to the airport," she said. "My flight isn't until evening." "Now, Raoul, you have to get dressed and go now. You left Neil in the bathtub." Her voice quavered, and at the same time it was beginning to rise, the sickening image flooding her all over again.
"I did?"
"Yes, Raoul," she said, fresh tears streaming down her face. "You passed out and you left our baby alone in a tub. You could have killed him, do you understand?" He turned away, his back to her. He pressed his head to a cupboard, twisting it slightly to either side, swearing to himself under his breath. Then, still without facing her, he said, "But he's okay, right, Didi? I peeked into his room this morning and he was asleep in the crib just fine." "You have to go now." Her words were coming out almost a whisper. She was aware that she sounded like a broken record. Fury had raged through her all night. That storm cloud had unleashed its rain, and now she was simply tired. "I've stayed away from it for months," he said. "I don't know what happened. I just had the tiniest bit." "Stop," she said. And he did. "I don't want to hear your explanation. Do you understand me? I don't want to hear it." He didn't try to speak again. He went upstairs to dress and get his bag, and then stood in the sitting room as she called a minicab for Heathrow. She held out £50 to cover the fare, and he took it from her. Then he left, going out to the street before the cab arrived. When it pulled up to the house, she went to the window, held back the lace curtain, and watched him slip into the back seat. Then the cab pulled away, leaving her to stare out at the gray morning light. She wasn't aware of when she'd stopped crying. She felt wide awake suddenly. She heard Neil upstairs stirring in his crib. In another minute he would cry out, wanting her, expecting breakfast. He was young enough so that Suda was still only goodness to him, nothing else. She returned to the kitchen, opened a cupboard, took out a packet of Weetabix, heated milk in a pan. Something brushed against her ankles, and she saw that the balloon tied to the back of Neil's high chair was no longer suspended on its ribbon. It had sagged to the floor, a shrunken thing incapable of bursting. She clipped the ribbon with scissors and stuffed the whole thing into the garbage, surprised at how easily it fit, thinking of the husband who no longer trusted her, of the son whose cry now interrupted her, of the fledgling family that had cracked open that morning, as typical and as terrifying as any other.
Nobody's business. Every so often a man called for Sang, wanting to marry her. Sang usually didn't know these men. Sometimes she had never even heard of them. But they'd heard that she was pretty and smart and 30 and Bengali and still single, and so these men, most of whom also happened to be Bengali, would procure her number from someone, who knew her parents, who, according to Sang, desperately wanted her to be married. According to Sang, these men always confused details when they spoke to her, saying that they'd heard that she studied physics when really it was philosophy, or that she'd graduated from Columbia when really it was NYU, calling her Sangeeta when really she went by Sang. They were impressed that she was getting her doctorate at Harvard, when really she dropped out of Harvard after a semester and was working part-time at a bookstore on the square. Sang's housemates, Paul and Heather, could always tell when it was a prospective groom on the phone. "Oh, hi," Sang would say, sitting at the imitation walnut kitchen table, rolling her eyes, coin-colored eyes that were sometimes green. She would slouch in her chair, looking bothered but resigned, as if a subway she were riding had halted between stations. To Paul's mild disappointment, Sang was never rude to these men. She listened as they explained the complicated, far-fetched connection between them, connections Paul vaguely envied in spite of the fact that he shared a house with Sang, and a kitchen, and a subscription to the Globe. The suitors called from as far away as Los Angeles, as close by as Watertown. Once, she told Paul and Heather, she had actually agreed to meet one of these men, and he had driven her north up I-93, pointing from the highway to the corporation he worked for. Then he'd taken her to a Dunkin' Donuts, where over crullers and coffee, he'd proposed. Sometimes, Sang would take notes during these conversations on the message pad kept next to the phone. She'd write down the man's name, or Carnegie Mellon, or likes mystery novels, before her pen drifted into scribbles and stars and tic-tac-toe games. To be polite, she asked a few questions, too, about whether the man enjoyed his work as an economist or a dentist or a metallurgical engineer. Her excuse to these men, her rebuttal to their offers to wine and dine her, was always the same white lie. She was busy at the moment with classes, it's being Harvard and all. Sometimes, if Paul happened to be sitting at the table, she would write him a note in the middle of the conversation. "He sounds like he's 12. Or, "Total dweeb." Or, "This guy threw up once in my parents' swimming pool," waving the pad for Paul's benefit as she cradled the phone to her ear. It was only after Sang hung up that she complained. "How dare these men call," she'd say. "How dare they hunt her down?" It was a violation of her privacy, an insult to her adulthood. It was pathetic. If only Paul and Heather could hear them going on about themselves. At this point, Heather would sometimes say, "God, Sang, I can't believe you're complaining. Dozens of men, successful men, possibly even handsome, want to marry you, sight unseen, and you expect us to feel sorry for you?" Heather, a law student at Boston College, had been bitterly single for 5 years. She told Sang the proposals were romantic, but Sang shook her head. "It's not love." In Sang's opinion, it was practically an arranged marriage. These men weren't really interested in her. They were interested in a mythical creature created by an intricate chain of gossip, a web of wishful Indian community thinking in which she was an aging, overlooked poster child for years of Bharatanatyam classes, perfect SATs. Had they any idea who she actually was and how she made a living, in spite of her test scores, which was by running a cash register and arranging paperback books in pyramid configurations, they would want nothing to do with her. "And besides," she always reminded Paul and Heather, "I have a boyfriend." "You're like Penelope," Paul ventured one evening. He had lately been rereading Lattimore's Homer in preparation for his orals in English literature the following spring. "Penelope?" She was standing at the microwave heating some rice. Paul watched as she removed the plate and mixed the steaming rice with a spoonful of the dark, red-hot lime pickle that lived next to his peanut butter in the door of the refrigerator. "From the Odyssey?" Paul said gently, a question to match her question. He was tall without being lank, with solid fingers and calves and fine straw-colored hair. The most noticeable aspect of his appearance was a pair of expensive designer glasses, their maroon frames perfectly round, which an attractive salesgirl in a frame shop on Beacon Street had talked him into buying. Paul had not liked the glasses, even as he was being fitted for them, and had not grown to like them since. "Right, the Odyssey," Sang said, sitting down at the table. "Penelope, only I can't knit." "Weave," he said, correcting her. "It was a shroud Penelope kept weaving and unweaving to ward off her suitors." Sang lifted a forkful of rice to her lips, blowing on it so that it would cool. "Then who's the woman who knits?" she asked. She looked at Paul. "You would know." Paul paused, eager to impress her, but his mind had drawn a blank. He knew it was someone in Dickens, had the paperbacks up in his room. "Be right back," he said. Then he stopped, relieved. "A Tale of Two Cities," he told her. "Madame Defarge." Paul had answered the phone the first time Sang called at 9 o'clock one Saturday morning in July in reference to the housemate ad he and Heather had placed in the Phoenix. The call had roused him from sleep, and he wondered, standing there groggy in his bathrobe, what sort of name Sang was, half expecting a Japanese woman. It wasn't until she wrote out a check for her security deposit at the end of her visit that he saw that her official name was Sangita Biswas. This was the name he would see on her mail, on the labels of the thick, pungent Vogue magazines she received each month, and in the window of the electric bill she agreed to take on. Heather had been in the shower when Sang arrived and pressed the doorbell that chimed two solemn tones, so Paul greeted her alone. She had worn her long hair loose, something Paul was to learn she rarely did, and as he walked behind her, he had liked the way it clung protectively to her body over the rise of her shoulder blades. She had admired the spectacular central staircase as most everyone did, letting her hand linger over the banister. The staircase turned 6 times at right angles after every 6 steps and was constructed of dark gleaming wood with the luster of cognac. It was the only thing of enduring beauty in the house, a false promise of what was above. Ugly brown cabinets in the kitchen, moldy bathrooms with missing tiles, omnipresent oatmeal carpeting to protect the ears of the landlords who lived below. She had remarked on what a lot of space it was, pacing the landing before joining Paul in the vacant room. There was a built-in hutch in the corner with Doric pilasters and glass-paned doors which Sang opened and closed. Paul told her that the room had originally been the dining room, the cabinet intended to store china. There was a bathroom across the landing. Paul and Heather shared the larger one, upstairs. "I feel like I'm standing inside an empty refrigerator," she'd said, referring to the fact that the walls, once blue, had been painted over with a single coat of white. The effect under the glare of the ceiling light was stark and cold. She ran a hand along one wall and carefully removed a stray piece of tape. Once there had been an arched doorway connecting the room to the kitchen, since filled in, but Sang noted that the arch was still visible like a scar in the plaster. While she was there, the phone rang, another person replying to the ad, but by then she had handed over her deposit. She had met Heather, and the three of them chatted in the living room with its peeling bay window and its soft, filthy couch and its yellow papasan chair. They told her about their system for splitting up the chores and about the landlords, both doctors at Brigham and Women's. They told her there was only one phone jack in the house, in the kitchen. The phone was attached to a cord so long that they could all drag it to their rooms, though at times the price to pay for dragging the cord too far was a persistent crackle. "We thought about having another line put in, but it's pretty expensive," Heather said. "It's not a big deal," Sang said. And Paul, who seldom spoke on the phone to anyone, said, "Nothing at all." She had practically nothing to contribute to the house. No pots or appliances, nothing for the kitchen apart from an ailing hanging plant that shed yellow heart-shaped leaves. A friend helped her move in one Sunday, a male friend who was not, Paul gathered, her boyfriend. For she had mentioned one on her first visit, telling them that he was in Cairo for the summer visiting his parents, that he was Egyptian, and that he taught Middle Eastern history at Harvard. The friend's name was Charles. He wore high-top sneakers and a bright orange bowling shirt, his hair tied back in a stubby ponytail. He was telling Sang about a date he'd had the night before as they unloaded a futon, 2 big battered suitcases, a series of shopping bags, and a few boxes from the back of a pickup truck. Paul had offered to help, calling out from the deck where he was trying to read the Canterbury Tales, but Sang said no, it was nothing. Their talk distracted him, and yet he remained watching Sang through the railing. Charles was teasingly forbidding her to buy too many things so that moving out would be just as easy. Sang had been laughing at him, but now she stopped, her expression pensive. She looked up at the house, a balled-up comforter in her arms. "I don't know, Charles. I don't know how long I'll be here." "He still doesn't want to live together until you're married?" She shook her head. "What does he say?" "That he doesn't want to spoil things." Charles shifted the weight of the box he was carrying. "But he acknowledges the fact that you're getting married?" She turned back to the truck. "He says things like, 'When we have kids, we'll buy a big house in Lexington.'"
"You've been together 3 years,"
Charles said. So he's a little old-fashioned. That's one of the things you like about him, right? The next few nights, Sang slept on the couch in the living room, her things stored temporarily in the corner in order to paint her room. Both Paul and Heather were surprised by this. Neither of them had made an effort to do much to their rooms when moving in. For the walls, she had chosen a soothing sage green. For the trim, the palest lavender, a color that the paint company called mole. It wasn't what she imagined a mole to look like at all, she told Paul, stirring the can vigorously on the kitchen counter. What would you have named it? She asked him suddenly. He could think of nothing. It was only upstairs, sitting alone at his big plywood desk, piled with thick books full of tissue-thin pages, that he thought of the ice cream his mother always ordered at the Newport Creamery when his family went on Sunday nights for hamburgers. His mother had died years ago, his father soon after. They'd adopted Paul late in life, when they were in their 50s, so people had often mistaken them for his grandparents. That evening in the kitchen, when Sang walked in, Paul said, Black raspberry.
What?
The paint. She had a small, slightly worried-looking smile on her face, a smile one might give a confused child.
That's funny.
The name?
No, it's just a little funny the way you picked up a conversation we had like 6 hours ago and expected me to remember what you were talking about.
As soon as Paul opened the door of his room the next morning, he detected the fresh yet cloying smell of paint, heard the swish of the roller as it moved up and down a wall. After Heather had left the house, Sang started to play music, one Billie Holiday CD after another. They were having a spell of sticky, sweltering days, and Paul was working in the relative cool of the living room, a few paces across the landing from Sang.
Oh my God, she exclaimed, noticing him on her way to the bathroom. This music must be driving you crazy.
She wore cut-off jeans, a black tank top with straps like those of a brassiere. Her feet were bare, her calves and thighs flecked with paint. He lied, telling her that he often studied to music. Because he noticed it was the kitchen she went to most often to rinse her brushes or to eat some yogurt out of a big tub, the second day he moved himself there, where he made a pot of tea, and, much to her amusement, set the alarm on his wristwatch to know when to take out the leaves. In the afternoon, her sister called, from London, with a voice identical to Sang's. For a moment, Paul actually believed it was Sang herself, mysteriously calling him from her room.
Cap Talk, I'm painting my room sage and mole, she reported cheerfully to her sister,
and when she replaced the receiver of the dark brown phone, there were a few of her mole-colored fingerprints on the surface. He liked studying in her fleeting company. She was impressed with how far he'd got on his PhD. She told him that after she'd dropped out of Harvard a year ago, her mother locked herself up in her bedroom for a week, and her father refused to speak to her. She had it with academia, hated how competitive it was, how monkish it forced one to become. That was what her boyfriend did, always blocking off chunks of his day and working at home with the phone unplugged, writing papers for the next conference.
You'll be good at it, she assured Paul. You're devoted, I can tell.
When she asked him what his exam entailed, he told her it would last 3 hours, that there would be 3 questioners, and that it would cover 3 centuries of English and European literature.
And they can ask you anything?
She wanted to know.
Within reason.
Wow.
He didn't tell her the truth, that he'd already taken the exam the year before and failed. His committee and a handful of students were the only ones who knew, and it was to avoid them that Paul preferred to stay at home now. He had failed not because he wasn't prepared, but because his mind had betrayed him that bright May morning, inexplicably cramped like a stubborn muscle that curled his foot during sleep. For 5 harrowing minutes, as the professors stared at him with their legal pads full of questions, as trains came and went along Commonwealth Avenue, he had not been able to reply to the first question about comic villainy in Richard III. He had read the play so many times he could picture each scene, not as it might be performed on stage, but rather as the pale printed columns in his Pelican Shakespeare. He felt himself go crimson. It was the nightmare he had been having for months before the exam. His interrogators were patient, tried another question, which he stammered miserably through, pausing in the middle of a thought and unable to continue until finally, One of the professors, white hair like a snowy wreath around his otherwise naked head, put out his hand, as might a policeman stopping traffic, and said, "The candidate's simply not ready." Paul had walked home, the tie he'd bought for the occasion stuffed into his pocket, and for a week he had not left the house. When he returned to campus, he was 10 pounds thinner, and the department secretary asked him if he'd fallen in love. Sang had been living with them for a week when a suitor called. By then, the painting was finished, the dreary room transformed. She was removing masking tape from the edges of the window panes when Paul told her someone named Asim Bhattacharya was calling from Geneva. "Tell him I'm not in," she said without hesitating. He wrote down the name, spelled out carefully by the caller who had said before hanging up, "Just tell her it's Pinku." More men called. One asked Paul dejectedly if he was Sang's boyfriend. The mere possibility articulated by a stranger jolted him. Such a thing had happened once before in the house. The first year Paul lived there, two housemates had fallen in love, had moved out in order to marry each other. "No," he told the caller, "I'm just her housemate." Nevertheless, for the rest of the day, he felt burdened by the question, worried that he'd transgressed somehow simply by answering the phone. A few days later, he told Sang. She laughed. "He's probably horrified now, knowing that I live with a man," she said. "Next time," she advised him, "say yes." A week afterward, the three of them were in the kitchen, Heather filling a thermos with echinacea tea because she had come down with a cold and had to spend all day in classes, Sang hunched over the newspaper and coffee. The night before, she had locked herself up in her bathroom, and now there were some reddish highlights in her hair. When the phone rang and Paul picked up, he assumed it was another suitor on the line, for, like many of Sang's suitors, the caller had a slight foreign accent, though this one was more refined than awkward. The only difference was that instead of asking for Sangeeta, he asked to speak to Sang. When Paul asked who was calling, he said in a slightly impatient way, "I'm her boyfriend." The words landed in Paul's chest like the dull yet painful taps of a doctor's instrument. He saw that Sang was looking up at him expectantly, her chair already partly pushed back from the table. "For me?" He nodded, and Sang took the phone into her room. "Boyfriend," Paul reported to Heather. "What's his name?" Paul shrugged. "Didn't say." "Well, she must be happy as a clam," Heather remarked with some asperity, screwing the lid onto her thermos. Paul felt sorry for Heather, with her red chapped nose and her thick, wasted body, but more than that, he felt protective of Sang.
"What do you mean?" he said.
"Because her lover's back, and now she can tell all those other guys to fuck off." The boyfriend was standing on the sidewalk with Sang, looking up at the house as Paul returned on his bike from a day of photocopying at the library. A bottle green BMW was parked at the curb. The couple stood with an assumed intimacy, their dark heads tilting towards each other. "Keep away from the window when you change your clothes," Paul heard him say. "I can see through the curtain. Couldn't you get a room at the back?" Paul stepped off his bike at a slight distance from them, adjusted the straps of his backpack. He was uncomfortably aware that he was shabbily dressed in shorts and Birkenstocks and an old Dartmouth t-shirt, his pale legs covered with matted blonde hair. The boyfriend wore perfectly fitted faded jeans, a white shirt, a navy blue blazer, and brown leather shoes. His sharp features commanded admiration without being imposing. His hair, in contrast, was on the long side, framing his face in a lavish, unexpected style. He looked several years older than Sang, Paul decided, but in certain ways he strongly resembled her, for they shared the same height, the same gilded complexion, the same sprinkle of moles above and below their lips. As Paul walked toward them, Sang's boyfriend was still inspecting the house, searching the yellow and ochre Victorian facade as if for defects, until he looked away suddenly, distracted by the bark of a dog. "Your roommates have a dog?" the boyfriend asked. He took an odd dance-like step to the left, moving partly behind Sang. "No, silly," Sang said teasingly, running her hand down the back of his head. "No dogs, no smokers. Those were the only listings I called, because of you." The barking stopped, and the ensuing silence seemed to punctuate her words. There was a necklace around her neck, lapis beads she now fingered in a way that made Paul think they were a gift.
Paul, this is Farouk.
Farouk's afraid of dogs. She kissed Farouk on the cheek. Freddy, Farouk said, nodding rather than extending a hand, his words directed more to Sang than to Paul. She shook her head.
For the millionth time, I'm not calling you Freddy.
Farouk glanced at her without humor. Why not? You expect people to call you Sang.
She was unbothered. That's different. That's actually a part of my name.
Well, I'm Paul, and that's pretty much all you can call me, Paul said. No one laughed.
Suddenly, she was never at home. When she was, she stayed in her room, often on the phone, the door shut. By dinner, she tended to be gone. The items on her shelf of the refrigerator, the big tubs of yogurt and the crackers and the tabbouleh, sat untouched. The yogurt eventually sported a mantle of green fuzz, setting off shrieks of disgust when Sang finally opened the lid. It was only natural, Paul told himself, for the two of them to want to be alone together. He was surprised to run into her one day in the small gourmet grocery in the neighborhood, her basket piled high with food she never brought back to the house. Purple net bags of shallots, goat cheese in oil, meat wrapped in butcher paper. Because it was raining, Paul, who had his car with him, offered her a ride. She told him no thank you and headed off to the tea stop, a Harvard baseball cap on her head, hugging the grocery bag to her chest. He had no idea where Farouk lived. He pictured a beautiful house on Brattle Street, French doors and pretty molding. It was always something of a shock to find Farouk in the house. He visited infrequently and seemed to appear and disappear without a trace. Unless Paul looked out the window and saw the BMW always precisely parked under the shade of the birch tree, it was impossible to tell if he was there. He never said hello or goodbye. Instead, he behaved as if Sang were the sole occupant of the house. They never sat in the living room or in the kitchen. Only once, when Paul returned from a bike ride, did he see them overhead eating lunch on the deck. They were sitting next to each other, cross-legged, and Sang was extending a fork toward Farouk's mouth, her other hand cupped beneath it. By the time Paul entered the house, they had retreated into her room. When she wasn't with Farouk, she did things for him. She read through proofs of an article he'd written, checking it for typos. She scheduled his doctor's appointments. Once, she spent all morning with the Yellow Pages pricing tiles. Farouk was thinking of redoing his kitchen. By the end of September, Paul was aware of a routine. Mondays, which Sang had off from the bookstore, Farouk came for